This is Rebecca Lowe, or Rebecca Lua, if you listen to Suboptimal Radio, and you are listening to Men in Blazers on the NBC Sports Network.
It's unbelievable!
Welcome to a Men in Blazers pod special. Our guest today is a Premier League manager who has overseen one of the most fascinating cultural and footballing renaissances of the past 12 months, transforming Crystal Palace from their traditional punchbag role as a relegation-fearing yo-yo club into one of the most entertaining, optimistic, passionate collectives in the English game. We welcome to the pod a man revered across South London and by Crystal Palace's growing band of admirers in the United States, the one and only Mr. Super Alan Pardew.
Well, that's a hell of an introduction. Hopefully I can live up to that introduction.
You know, I believe you can, Alan, because few men in football have had a year like the 2015 that you've had. You returned to a club at which you were a hero as a player back in January, Crystal Palace admired in the relegation zone, but against the odds, you lead them to the promised land of mid-table. And this campaign, beyond that, currently sixth place on the cusp of Europe. Can we get your gut check about the season so far? Where are Palace in terms of your plan for this campaign?
Well, what we've tried not to change is how we play, which is an aggressive attacking style based around the traditions of this football club, which is a working class background, tough players, tough environments they grow up in, and utilising that and the street football that we kind of players that we produce, and to have a first team that represents all of that. There's a very, very high level in the English Premier League, higher than anywhere else in the world in terms of depth of quality. You do need little bits and pieces of some international flavour, which we have in the team as well, particularly Yohan Cabaye, and it's probably his signing and his influence that has taken us a little step forward this season as a prior to last season.
We will talk about Yohan Cabaye in a minute, but I want to talk about you, Alan, because when I think about you, I think about you first as a player back in the day. I think about your career as one which I marvel about just because of the tenacity and determination that it took you. Your original road into professional football was as a midfielder. It was a long and grinding one. You started your life as a glazier, working building sites in the capital. You kept working part-time as you moved into non-league football. Teams like Whiteleaf, the Corinthian Casuals, Epsom and Ewell. And you didn't actually make league football until you were 26. Second division then, Crystal Palace came in. Was there a moment in your life, Alan, when you thought, Alan Pardew is going to be a building site glazier who had a nice but unmemorable non-league football career?
No, I never actually thought that. I don't think anyone who works on a building site thinks that, because you're always aspiring to something better, of course. My outlet was football, and I was pretty good at it. But as you quite rightly say, I'd reached 26, which in professional football terms or in any sport is late to come into the professional game. But I was lucky. I come to a good club and a good manager who trusted me. And my career lasted till I was 35. So I had 10 years at the top level. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And, you know, obviously your playing career usually is the best years of your life. But I've been lucky and fortunate enough to have a few good years as a manager. And hopefully even more to come.
Yeah, I mean, Palace swept in. You were 26. You made 168 appearances for them. I remember watching you. You're a hard-working midfielder. You had fantastic, fantastic blonde frosted tip highlights. How would you describe your style of play to Americans who never had the opportunity to see Super Alan actually take the field?
Well, I think the best way of describing me was a no-nonsense kind of mythical player. I wouldn't really put up with any fancy Dan messing about, or anyone trying to overindulge in technical play. I would be on top of them. I would try to dominate my opponent and obviously try and contribute to the football. A lot of my playing career was based around my energy. I really had good energy and could make both boxes very, very quickly. So that was probably what I was about. But, you know, it was natural for me to kind of have leadership in me. And when times of my position was threatened because players were slightly technically better than me, it was probably my leadership qualities that the manager kept faith in me, and thank goodness for that.
I mean, you went on to score the most famous goal in Palace history to beat Liverpool in the FA Cup semi-final in 1990, which Steve Parish told us that was the moment the Super Alan Pardew chant went from being ironic to being sung with full true passion. But you made the transition from player to manager with Reading 1998. How did your grinding odyssey through the lower leagues condition you and shape your management philosophy, different from other managers who are elite players themselves?
Well, I've always been a studier of coaching, always been interested in. I used to run a Sunday team when I was a football player at 27. So I was always interested in running my own team. I was a big fan of the NFL. I used to read a lot of books on some of your cultural icons, particularly Mr. Vince Lombardi, who's one of my heroes. So I was always, I always enjoyed passing over the information that I'd gained. But of course, managing and playing to all the levels give me a real insight into people's personalities at the different levels. I think that's probably where my man management skills have been honed. I can understand what a top international player, what excites, what gets him his juices going, as the same to a young player who's coming out from a rough background who's just broke into the team. So, you know, you need to be able to relate to all these guys all through their age groups from sort of 10 to 37, 38 is probably our maximum age. And, of course, staff as well that you have to manage. So there's a lot to it, but I thoroughly enjoy it. And it's meeting people and dealing with people that I love.
Vince Lombardi, Green Bay, not dissimilar to Crystal Palace, both incredibly passionate catchment areas. You were saying earlier, working class brands.
The kind of spirit that he created at Green Bay is very much what we're about. You know, our working class background of our fans needs to be seen on the pitch. The fight, the determination to grind, which we showed just recently on Monday night against Everton. It wasn't our best technical game, but the grind, the fight, the will to win that Green Bay inspired in that era is very much part of our DNA.
I'm still dreaming of Dan and Delaney. Oh, filling my nightmares, these two gentlemen are. But I've got to ask you, management, you talked about your philosophy, how you entered it. You have to do so much, be a tactical genius, a man manager, a sports psychologist, a data analyst, communications expert, transfer genius. What is the most important single skill a manager must have in the Premier League?
Well, for me, the word I would use is consistency of message, because whether you're dealing with the media, or you're dealing with your players, or you're dealing with your staff, if you jump in from one decision that makes no sense to another decision, then you're going to have problems somewhere down the line. So it's about consistency of form of what you're delivering, consistency in what you coach, consistency in what you're saying in the dressing room, that you're saying the same message to a young player as you're giving to an experienced player, which might be difficult. It might be some criticism of a senior player who might not want to take it too well. You've got to deliver it with the same passion and the same level of degree that you would a young player. And of course, in the today's day and age, you have to move at a time. So consistency and making sure that you move, because you can't stay the same. You stay the same, the level we're at, and I'm afraid people are going to go past you. So always trying to improve, but having that consistency that runs parallel with that.
Let me take you back to a time of the road less taken, Alan. Last December, you were struggling at Newcastle. Neil Warnock left Crystal Palace. They were deep in the relegation zone. And you.
Well, let me correct you on one thing.
Go on.
When I left Newcastle, it wasn't me who was struggling. It was the fans who were struggling a little bit. The club, if I'm honest. We were ninth in the Premier League. In fact, we were quite comfortable at that stage. We'd just beat Everton, ironically, who we just last played here. So it wasn't as straightforward a decision as people thought. But I genuinely come back here because I thought the DNA of what I wanted to do, the way I wanted to run a club, this would fit me much, much better. And of course, I knew everybody as I entered the stadium. I knew I would get the backing from the public, from the players, and from the board, and more importantly. So it gave me a chance to build something, and I'm not going to waste that chance.
Your first game back, the fans resurrected the chant they had for you as a player, Super Alan Pardew. After surviving that, whatever the position of Newcastle was, it must have been emotionally challenging. Can you describe how it felt to walk out onto that field at Selhurst Park, the most amazing fan culture I've been to in the current Premier League? What did it feel like for you personally to hear that chant break out around Crystal Palace for the first time?
I think just going back to Newcastle, that had some impact, because the last two or three months, it was difficult in terms of the fans were not happy with the investment in the team. They wasn't happy with the results we were getting, although I thought they were good for the team we had. So we had a lot of problems and a lot of bad feeling. Of course, the contrast of that was to come to Palace. And as you say, walking out and that greeting and that passion and love for me is going to lift anyone's spirit. And although I'm a hard-nosed manager and pretty thick skin, you know, it was also a really nice moment for me and my family to come back to an area we know well and have that love without even kicicking the ball. You know, I hadn't even got a result and they were singing my name as a manager. So, of course, that gives you even extra desire to deliver for them. And so far, we, as a staff, we've managed to do that.
I mean, you righted the ship at Palace and then some. The club ended the season in 10th place. I recently read you talked about how you did that. They were relegation bound. You turned it around. You said, I injected some confidence. I got the players to be braver. We've all watched Jurgen Klopp over the past month or so turn a dejected set of players around at Liverpool. How does a manager go about, quote, injecting confidence, Alan? Strategically, how do you do that?
Well, I think what Klopp has done at Liverpool is similar to what I've done here in terms of the start, because you can tell by his body language, the way he set his team up, is that he's not going to give the opposition any respect. And you inject confidence by being brave in your selection of the team and your selection of tactics, because players will read between the lines of your tactics. If you're suddenly starting to say, well, this is a strong team, we need to protect ourselves, we can hit them on the break, you're sending messages that it is not going to be carried through when you're taking over a team that should be doing better. You need to go the other way and say, we're going on the front foot, we're going to get after this team, we're better than them, and this is how we're going to do it, and have a strategic plan. Once you put that in the team, then the message is clear. Even if you're going to set up a team to put on the break, which we do on occasions here, the message is still positive then, because you can also switch to the other message very, very quickly when you need to, when you go a goal behind, for example. It really is about message, constant, consistent message you're giving to the players that we are good enough and we can compete against anybody if we follow the game plan. And the game plan needs to read positive for the players, needs to have a kind of intelligence to it. They go, yeah, we can do that. I can see where we're going with that.
I mean, when I think of Palace's DNA historically, the fans, they don't just like to win, but they demand an entertaining style of football, a bit of flair, some flash, wingers, Attilio Lombardo, John Salako, Peter Taylor, played on teams that scored for fun. They'd also concede a fair few in the process.
Yeah.
Well, you've got buccaneering players now, the Blassies, the Zahas, the Punchins. What tweaks have you made to turn that adventurous, counter-attacking football into winning football?
Well, of course, you, like all good teams, like all good NFL teams, NBA teams, and the rugby that we play here, and you need a strong defence. You cannot start unleashing offensive players to go charging at the opposition without the back door being firmly shut. We're currently fourth, fifth best defence in the Premier League. For a club of our size, that is a tremendous achievement, the way we play as well, where we play quite open. So our discipline of our defenders has been outstanding. And you mentioned two names there, Dan and Delaney, who have been massive for us in terms of giving us a foundation to go forward. But we won't ever stop putting players like Zaha, Balassi, Sacco on the pitch, because that is us. If you look historically at this football club, we've produced wingers, usually from ethnic backgrounds, who have been up against it and have now played street football all their young lives and have got tricks and skills that they want to show, and show people that from whatever background they come, they have an exuberant and a quality that they want to show the world. And that's the type of players that I like, and the type of players that we'll always have in this team as long as I'm here, for sure.
This season, you've won 13 points away compared to 9 at home. Selhurst Park, there is nowhere finer. It's a tiny cauldron. But why are you playing so much better on the road in your mind, Alan?
Well, I don't think we are, actually, this year. I really don't. I think we've been excellent at home. If you look at our fixtures, you'll find we've played some really, really big sides at home, and we've done well, and we just haven't got the result. We've had Man City at home, we've had Arsenal at home, we've had Man United. Two of those we lost, one we drew. And we certainly should have won one of them, for sure. And that would have put us level on our away points. I think our home form is good. I think it's going to improve in the second half of the season. All backed, of course, by a stadium, as you quite rightly say, that is special. And if anyone visiting London, if you want to go to a game and get a flavour for what a Premier League game and atmosphere, you ain't going to find anywhere finer than the Crystal Palace. I promise you that.
Prepare for the American invasion of South London. You mentioned the street footballers, you mentioned the Zahas, you mentioned the brand of youthful South Londoners that you have traditionally developed. But in the off-season, you upgraded in fantastic fashion with the arrival of Johan Cabaye, a playmaker who, quality-wise, is world-class. You had him at Newcastle, but Palace went into Paris Saint-Germain, put down $19.2 million. And I don't say this to be rude, Alan, and tell me if I am, but Paris Saint-Germain do not typically do a lot of business with Crystal Palace. Can you talk about the case you made to Johan and his representatives to take what was then seen as an unorthodox pathway to join you at Palace?
Well, the first part of that equation was that at PSG, Johan Cabaye wasn't getting a regular game. And that's understandable, because they are probably the richest football club in the world, bar none. So to try and take out one of their prize assets was never going to be easy. You have French directors and Arab owners, and that combination is very difficult because of time scales and the location of personnel. So before we'd even got that far, I knew from my experience at Newcastle that Johan Cabaye wants to play. The money is not his greatest motivator, and most footballers it isn't, ironically, but the market dictates their level of pay, and of course the market had dictated that Johan earned a lot of money at PSG. So we had to firstly find the financial package that was going to work for the club, our club, for PSG, and of course for Johan. Once we got that together, it was then a process of trying to persuade PSG that we were serious, that we could deliver this finance, and more importantly, that Johan would come. And of course, it took many, many phone calls, many discussions for all that to be put together. And the PSG, I have to say, were very honourable in their dealings with it. For Johan, the Euro Championships, it's in France, of course. And I said to him that I think we have a platform here in London with this Premier League team for him to secure his place in the French team. And I'm pleased to say, at the moment, that has been the case. So I didn't sell him a false picture. I told him this team is better than he thinks. It's the name that's not particularly desirable at the moment compared to the Man United and the Manchester Cities. But certainly we are trying to make inroads to those guys. And he trusted me.
Thank God for you. Club chairman Steve Parrish speaks superlative Arabic. That must have helped also. I've got to ask you, can you say a word about youth development? So many young players come through your club, South London born, South London bred. Palace have got to compete with the same youth players as Chelsea, Arsenal, Spurs. How does that competition impact the kind of players, the kind of raw materials you end up engaging at Palace? Because you talk about being street footballers, smaller footballers that you engage.
Well, firstly, we have to have a completely different market. And so therefore, we scout slightly different to the top clubs. We have a lot of migrants in the area who actually have only just joined schools. They're bringing talent into the country that we have to be first pick on. We look for players who've been struggling at school because of financial difficulties. We try and take care of them. But the most important thing is we look for players who love the game. And it doesn't matter what the background is. If they love the game and they're willing to learn, then we got the coaching ability here at this football club within the whole structure to bring them on. And of course, at the first team, they need to see that pathway. We currently have a player on loan at the moment in England called Sule Kaikai, who's done very, very well. Now, he needs to make the path to my first team next year, because that just triggers everybody below, of course. It needs to be seen from top to bottom that it works, and we think it does. But we're currently trying to put things together, me and Steve Parrish, to have a youth development system here that is different to everybody else. There's some news to come on that, hopefully.
No one knows better than a Premier League club. We're about to enter the holiday season. Games come in thick, come fast. Southampton, Swansea, Bournemouth, Stoke. It's heaven for football fans. But for a Premier League football manager, Alan, how do you describe, how do you experience the holidays in the Premier League?
With dread. It was one of my favourite. No, they're one of my favourite times, if I'm honest. I love the festive games. I hope they never go out of a calendar. Boxing Day is a traditional day here. A bit like Thanksgiving Day in America, where it's sport day. You know, you got your meal, you got your family, but it's football. So I love that day. But, you know, training every day, I have no problem with that. My family are well more than used to it. We fit our time in around that. Christmas Day, we'll be training. So present opening, usually 7 a.m. the first batch. And then we train, then we'll have dinner. I'll have dinner at home. All my players will have dinner at home. I'll make sure of that. And then we'll go to the hotel in the evening to go and play Bournemouth on Boxing Day. So great period. On a manager level, and that's a personal level, injuries is the biggest issue. And the fact that you'll be playing games 2 days apart, and you can't play a normal Premier League game 2 days apart because of the fitness levels of the team. So it'll be interesting, the game after Boxing Day. There probably could be a few bizarre results that particular weekend or week, game, whatever it is. So if you want to bet on some freak results, that's your one.
I mean, typically when I think about this holiday period, it's the time of the season where the true contenders separate from the pack. But this has been a season in which anyone can beat anyone. I mean, last weekend, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City tumbled, United held goalless. As a Premier League manager, how do you understand what's going on with the parity this season?
For me, it's the logical of the teams below getting stronger, and the teams above are not quite as strong as they were, which I think is something that we, at the moment, is a fault in the Premier League. Our top teams need to be better, and we're exposing that. The Leicester, ourselves, Stoke and Southampton, Everton and Tottenham are chasing hard this year, and that will continue to the end of the year. But one of the reasons the top teams traditionally fare better over the festive period is because they have the quality and depth. And it's that we're going to have to lean on Crystal Palace, that our squad can stand up to the pressures of injuries. And that's a test for us.
What does it make you think is possible for Crystal Palace, this equality, this parity, this strengthening of the middle, the weakening of the big teams? Alan, this season, is everything up for grabs?
Well, ironically, I spoke to Roberto Martinez, the Everton manager, after the game, and we both feel that this is an opportunity this year, particularly for the fourth Champions League place, because you know, if you look and say Chelsea have got a lot to do to get there, then that leaves Liverpool, Everton, Spurs, I think, as the three main contenders. But then you've got to look at us, Southampton and Stoke, and as long as if we get to the end of February and we're in this position, we'll be fighting for a Champions League place. But at the moment, we're fighting to be competitive for the Europa League place. That's the honest truth.
Alan, you do not know how happy those words that you have just spoken have made me feel. It is great to speak with you. We wish you, over the holiday period, we wish you and Steve Parrish, who's a great friend of the pod, all the best. And for 2016, in which you build on all that you've begun this year, 2015. Godspeed, Alan Pardew.
Well, thank you. And to all our American fans, I hope to see you down at Selhurst one day. If you ever can see me passing on the sideline, make sure you shout out to me.
You don't know what you've
Give me a woo-hoo.
You don't know what you've just brought down upon yourself, Alan Pardew. Have a great holiday period. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
What a gent. And listeners, if you are headed to London, I can't encourage you enough to make good on Alan's invite to head to Selhurst Park and savour the full-throated Crystal Palace experience for yourself. It's one of the most passionate, vociferous fan cultures I've savoured in the modern game. I recently made a documentary film about it with NBCSN, South London and Proud, and that can be viewed online in its entirety on NBCSportsWorld.com. We've also popped a link up on meninblazers.com. And for more on Palace's exhilarating five-year transformation, there's a link there too for our pod special with club chairman and CEO, Mr. Steve Parrish. A fantastic bloke, a fantastic story. We'll be back next week with more courage.